are the implications of having a background flux? And for me, a background flux is always something which is a closed, not closed form. It's an odd to be closed form. What happens when you have an odd degree closed form? Well, you can always think of this, and I'm not going to emphasize this, but you can always think of this as the curvature of a jerk. Where the rank of the jerk, or the level of the jerk, is the same as the curvature, minus 3 or something. But the idea is just in the same way that a closed two-form can be interpreted more or less as the curvature of a line bundle, it's sometimes useful to interpret these fluxes as being curvature integers, especially when you want these to have integral cohomology fluxes. So if you want to restrict, let's say, H3 to be integral, then the geometric way of interpreting that is as a curvature of a jerk, because as long as it's interpreted this way, then this curvature will always have integral cohomology fluxes. But then, kind of conversely, you could consider jerks which have zero curvature, but which are still non-trivial. Like, for example, the spin C jerk, which exists on any manifold, ratio manifold, is a jerk which kind of explains which submanifolds have a spin C orientation on their normal bundle. This is a jerk that has torsion cohomology class. And because it is a torsion class, its curvature will be zero, but still somehow this jerk is non-trivial and kind of defines you a kind of background. This background influences everything. It influences the topological situation and the differentiable situation and then the geometrical situation. At every level, the background affects it. So it's, you should think of this background as being somehow primitive, more primitive than metric or than a complex structure or than anything else. Okay, so but what can you do with such a thing? Well, one thing that when you have a jerk with curvature, you can ask, where does this jerk trivialize? So the question was, where does it trivialize? And this question, from this point of view, just forgetting about jerks, is the question, suppose we find a submanifold, let's say, embedded in by F into N, a submanifold. Okay? Such that when we pull back this flux, okay, this dot just means that it can have any odd degree. And when I pull back this thing, it's actually exact. We'll do like this. So this is odd. This is even. Okay, so there's only so many submanifolds for which this is true. I mean, not all submanifolds will have this very special condition that the jerk trivializes on a submanifold. When you do find a submanifold which is like that, then something very special happens, which is suppose. So whenever we have an odd degree closed form, we can always produce the operator, as I did yesterday, D plus H wedge. And this is an operator from the even forms to the odd forms. Okay, and back.
You restrict to odd degree forms because you want to keep the Z2.
Not only that, I want d squared to vanish, which means I need h wedge h to 0. This is important. So
it's not a necessary condition there.
No. But so. All right. So, well, let's just consider the odd situation for now. I mean, I'm only considering the 3 situation, but I'll just see explain why 3 is special among the odd degrees. Okay. So when you have such a submanifold, Then suppose that we have a class in, or let's say a form on the large manifold, such that dh rho equals zero. So we have a class in the twisted cohomology.
Can I ask a good question?
Yeah.
Why are you saying x? Doesn't x all
okay. So this, I just want to mention that this operator determines, well, let's call this operator dh, and this operator determines a cohomology, which is called the twisted cohomology of the manifold. And there are, when you think of this as being an integral class, especially as a germ, then you can see how you can twist all kinds of other cohomology theories, any cohomology theory, like K theory or anything else. Okay, so if you can find a form which satisfies this, then what you notice is that there's a natural pullback from these closed forms onto this submanifold. What I mean by that is this, that if we, if suppose that we pull back this form to the sub to n, right, and then we apply E to this f dot to it. So this f is only supported on the submanifold n. Okay. So pull the form back, and then multiply by the exponential of this even mixed degree form. Right? Then if we take the differential of this, the usual differential of this, then I'm going to get df dot, which ef f pull back rho, and then plus e to the f f d rho. And then this d rho is just minus h restricted to m wedge rho. Okay. And we know that h restricted to m is equal to minus df. And then because f is even here, df commutes with e to the f. And so we see that this is zero. So this means that you get a pullback. So e to the f f upper star is a pullback from h, the twisted cohomology of n, a large manifold, the ambient manifold, to the cohomology of n. Or by Frank-Ray duality, this means that you get a map, a generalized Tom isomorphism called that, from H of the manifold into, let's say, this plus the four dimension of m of n. So the point about this is that when you have a flux here, the flux kind of picks out a class of special submanifolds on which it trivializes. And if you had such a submanifold, then you have a nice way of pushing back usual cohomology into just cohomology. And this kind of phenomenon is a very general one. For example, if instead of having this gerb with curvature, if I had something like a spin C gerb or some other kind of gerb, then it allows you on these special submanifolds to push forward cohomology things like K theory. And so maybe for a physicist, one way to think about it is that the gerb tells you on which submanifolds you're allowed to wrap things. And what those things are could be K theory classes, or it could be special kinds of geometrical structures. So it somehow singles out some of these structures. Now, I mean, the way that it works is that if you want to wrap something topological, then all you need is the topological flux, right? The topological conditions of trivialization, right? But if you want to have, let's say you have a complex manifold and you want to know what are the special submanifolds on which d-brains can exist, then you not only need this kind of the topology of this gerb, you need actually to choose a connection, you need this actual form. So the level of detail that you need for this flux is proportional to the kind of thing you want to, I don't know, see that it wraps on the submanifold. I don't know if that's at all interesting. Okay, so having said that, let's see what happens from a differentiable point of view when you have such a flux. So now, So now suppose that we have H, and then we produce this dH operator, twisted differential. And we see that this acts on the spinners, where the spinners are again the differential forms, like I explained yesterday. So we get this something that looks kind of like a Dirac operator, but it's not. It squares to zero. But it's a natural differential operator on the spinners of the bundle t plus t square. Okay. So the fact that it has this natural operator means that we can generate a bracket operation. On the Clifford algebra that acts here, so the Clifford algebra of t plus t sub. So remember that, okay, so we start off with this metric bundle t plus t star. We produce this Clifford algebra bundle, and this Clifford algebra bundle acts on these spin bundles, okay? So we have something that's acting, and we have a differential operator on the thing it's acting on, okay? And so what we're going to do is use that differential operator to produce a bracket operation here. So how is this defined? You just say that the bracket of two sections, A and B, is just, so I'm going to define how it acts on a spinner. The way it acts on a spinner is by the graded commutator of this. Okay. So here, this is what I'm going to call the Courant bracket. And the Courant bracket of two sections acting on the spinner is defined to be, so what is this? These brackets are just commutators, whereas this is the Courant bracket. So here we take the commutator of A and BH, and then FYB in this way. So this is called the derived bracket construction. Now you have to be extremely careful with this kind of derived bracket, because the result that you get, so if you do this bracket, the result that you get might not be tensorial, so it might not be a tensor, it might be a differential operator. I've just explained something that acts on spinners here, and here we have a differentiation, right? So the result of this might be a differential operator. I haven't proven to you that it's not. Okay, but but there's a very special case where it does specialize to. it is a tensor. So if we choose A and B inside T plus wedge T star, then the bracket A and B is a section of T plus stuff. So what this is saying is that as long as A and B are in the Clifford algebra, so this is isomorphic to the exterior algebra of the whole space T plus T star. So A and B, you can think of them as having possibly many tangent components and many cotangent components. Okay. And here, what this is saying is that if you want the thing to be a tensor, then you're only allowed A and B to have only one tangent component. They can have as many cotangent components as they want, but if you want this to work out, then you need them to be in here. Of course, there are other sub-bundles of this super algebra bundle which work as well, but the whole subject of studying which ones will work and which ones are not is not really well developed. We have no kind of good handle on what's going on with this bracket operation on the phone. If anyone has insight into what's going on here, then I and many other people would like to know. But anyway, we know for sure that these are good places to work. Okay, so right away we see. So then what is this bracket? So I mean, I've defined it to you here, but let's work it all out. If we did this whole commutator, then the result would be, say we have x plus psi and y plus theta, and we want to take their bracket. So this is in T, and this is some differential form, same here. Well, he wrote down the expression yesterday. First of all, we take the Lie bracket of the two vector parts. So that's the vector part of the answer. But then there's going to be a one-form part. The one-form part is Lie derivatives. And then there's an extra term, which is important. This is just, again, contracting the vector with the k form, say, taking the derivative, so we get another k form. These are all k forms.
They're not necessarily one.
No. Here I'm taking these in the higher powers. Okay. And then there's an extra term, because I remember I used this special twisted operator, dh, right? So where does h come in here? Well, there's an extra term here, which is ix, iy, h. All right. So in particular, so this Courant bracket is defined on this bundle here, and it's given by this expression. And we see that the degree of the twist of the flux affects is exactly the same as the degree of this part of the bundle that we're working on, called minus 2. So because I'm working with T plus T star, right, then all I care about is H3. But if I wanted to work with higher fluxes, then what that means is that I would have to study, if I wanted to work with H5, then I would have to study the geometry of this bundle. And okay, well, I don't think many people have looked at that, but there might be something very interesting. This is the reason why reflux is important for me, because I'm studying the geometry of T plus T star. Okay. Is that clear? Okay, so then the most important fact about this Courant bracket graphs is the fact that it has an enhanced symmetry group. What I mean by that? What I mean is that certainly diffeomorphisms of the manifold. So if I didn't have this flux here, then this operation is totally natural in the differential structure. So that means that any diffeomorphism would preserve this part of the bracket. If the diffeomorphism also preserved this flux, then it would be certainly a symmetry. So diffeomorphisms which preserve H are inside the symmetry group of this bracket. That's obvious. But there is another piece to the symmetry group, and that's you can see that from the following calculation. You can suppose that we have a let me write it like this. I'll just write it, and then I'll explain what it is. if I have a, an even form here, even form, and this is the odd form that I use to twist, okay? So if I take the Courant bracket of these two sections and then apply this exponential of an even form, then this, you can take this into the bracket like this, as long as you change the twisting to h plus cb. So that means that, what this means is that if db equals 0, then e to the b is a symmetry.
How does e to the b act in the vector part?
It doesn't. Remember that x plus psi gets sent to x plus psi plus ix b. So b is a shear, remember? You have t and t star or whatever, and anything here gets sheared in this direction. But it doesn't affect the tension component.
So the exterior exponential and the Clifford exponential are the same here. For b.
Yeah. I mean, the two form part of the algebra acts, by the way, in a spin representation. It's, yeah. Okay, so then the proposition, if you want, is that this tells you the entire symmetry group. So the symmetry group is exactly the closed even form semi-direct product with the diffeomorphism. And that's what I mean by enhanced symmetry.
Is it possible to the symmetry of the space of sections that isn't induced by a symmetry of the vector moment?
Well, that's a good question. So what do I mean by symmetry? So symmetry is always going to be, so we have this bundle. Well, okay, I'll just put it for t plus t star, but say we have manifold 1 and then t plus t star manifold 2. Okay. So what I mean by symmetry is a diffeomorphism and some covering map on the bundle, some covering bundle map over that thing. So here we have diffeomorphism, so obviously you're allowed to have a diffeomorphism, but if you just say we want a diffeomorphism with some bundle map that covers it, then this has to be one of these. So that's what I can guess.
Actually, it looks to me like the symmetry group would be larger, because you could apply an arbitrary diffeomorphism and then do a transformation like this to cancel out the change in H.
To cancel out the...
If you applied an arbitrary diffeomorphism that at least preserves the cohomology class of H, then that diffeomorphism changes H by an exact form, and then you exponentiate to cancel that out.
Okay, well, that's a good point, and I can't respond to that right now, but I don't know the answer to that, but I still think that this is correct. But if you want, the thing that I'm certain of is if you remove H, then this is definitely true. So this, if H is 0, this is certain. So I think that probably addresses your question. No? Okay, well, let me leave that to later. We'll speak about this later, and I'll correct it tomorrow.
Could you say something about the Jacobian identity?
Yeah, I will. That's next. Very impatient. Okay. Okay. So the next line in my notes is that the Courant bracket is not a B bracket because it doesn't satisfy the Jacobian identity. So what we want to do is see to what extent it is a B-bracket. So we want to check. So we'll form the Jacobiator of three sections. And this is exactly the thing which is supposed to vanish. So we take, so if we take the brackets, I'm just going to omit the h, but there's an h everywhere if you want to say. So if we take the brackets of a and b and then take it back to q, and we sum with the cyclic permutations, right, this is supposed to vanish for the Jacobian n. But it doesn't. It's actually equal to a quantity which is the, which is actually a form, which is, so everything I'm going to say from now on is about t plus t sum. Is the theory of the square brackets in the higher ones is not exactly the same as what I'm about to say. Okay. But in t plus t star, this is not a big bracket. Whereas in t plus 1, for example, if I just took wedge 0 t star, that would be a big bracket. But in this case, in the degree 1 case, it's not a big bracket. And the discrepancy is actually a one form, which is d of function. That function is, I'll call it the Neuhaus of a, b, and c, plus a term which is, I'll write like this, dh. So it's the derivative of a function plus the derivative of this h contracted with the three vector parts of a, b, and c. Okay. But since I'm taking this to be closed, this quantity vanishes. Okay. Now, this derivative, this quantity, the Neuhaus of a, b, and c. What is that? Well, that's, it's important to write this down. So it's one third of the inner product of a, b bracket with c plus the cyclic permutations. So that means that the discrepancy from it being an actual b bracket is measured by this inner product in this way. So this is actually a quantity. Okay, so right away, the important thing to realize is this. So this is a fact that was noticed by Courant and Weinstein. It may seem obvious from the way that I've developed the subject, but it certainly was not obvious at the time. This was a very shocking thing. So if we find a subbundle of t plus t star, subbundle, such that, first of all, L is maximal isotropic, so it's Lagrangian if you want. So I'll just write max isotropic. And also that L is closed, or I'll write the sections of L are closed under Courant bracket. Then what happens? Okay. So let's take a look here. So let's compute this Neuhaus where A, B, and C are taken to be sections in L. So if A and B are sections in L, then because L is closed under Courant, the bracket is inside L. And then we have an inner product, something in L, and we know that it's Lagrangian, so that has to vanish. So that means that this quantity vanishes. So then the Neuhaus when you restrict to L is zero. Okay. And that implies that this bracket is a V bracket on sections of L. And then what they did was they studied this type of structure, and this is called a Dirac structure. Okay, so let me just give you an example of such a Dirac structure. So examples. So one example is just the tangent bundle itself. It's, first of all, it's Lagrangian, the metric vanishes on it, and It's also closing the current bracket because the current bracket is just a lead bracket, right? So it's just a lead bracket when you restrict it to companion members. So it's obviously closed if h is equal to 0. Okay, because remember, there's that extra piece. Let's say x and y are in the tangent bundle, and then the Coulomb bracket is just the lead bracket on x and y plus ix, iy, and h. So there's a one-form piece. So if h is 0, then this is closed, and it's a Dirac structure. But then we know that, remember that there are those symmetries in the Coulomb bracket, right? So that means that if we take the tangent bundle and we apply a symmetry to it, then we're going to get another Dirac structure. Now, it's an obvious thing. So what are the symmetries? Well, there's diffeomorphisms. So what happens with the tangent bundle if we apply a diffeomorphism? Nothing happens, right? It's natural under diffeomorphisms. But if we apply a B-field transformation, okay, then we get e to the t, which is the space of x plus ixb. Or in other words, it's the graph of this two-form. Okay? Then this is Dirac, if and only if the differential of this v is equal to h. So I'm just showing that that here we can take a Dirac structure and produce a new one. So in particular, if h is 0, then closed two forms are Dirac. So Dirac structures incorporate the idea, the notion of a closed two form. But that's not the only example. Let's take the opposite example. The opposite example is T star. T star is also Lagrangian, and it has and it's closed under the Courant bracket because the Courant bracket of two one forms is just 0. So the bracket is trivial on T star. So this is Dirac. Okay. And now we have the kind of interesting phenomenon which I'll describe here. So we've taken T star to be the Dirac structure. So there's T star, right? And we know that the symmetries of the whole Courant structure involve these shifts in the T star direction. And these shifts all do nothing at all to T star. So there's no symmetries to act here. But that doesn't mean that it's not possible to apply an orthogonal transformation, say one that moves T star up here, say. And this orthogonal transformation sends T star to something which is integrable, but it's not a symmetry of the whole structure. It's just taking one integrable thing to another. But it's for example, if there was another integrable thing, then this one might be ruined by this operation. And there are actually such operations. So suppose that we have jbeta, which is a bivector, so it's a section of the second exterior power of the tangent bundle. Okay, then we can view beta as a map. Well, beta is part of the Lie algebra, as I explained before, of t plus t squared. And we can apply e to the beta. Beta is something which does exactly this. It's a shift along the t direction. We apply e to the beta to t squared, and this is Dirac. If and only if, and we have to check this, it's derived if and only if the Poisson bracket, or sorry, the bracket of this beta itself is exactly beta star h. So what this means is h is in wedge 3 in the cotangent bundle, but beta is a map from t star to t. So that means that beta star h is inside wedge 3, 2. Okay. This notation just means that you invert all the indices using beta. Okay. And so what this is saying is that the bracket of beta itself is this trivector. And if H, if the flux was zero in, then what you would get is a Poisson structure. Okay, so if H is zero, Poisson. Okay.
And I'm not quite sure what beta star H means still. That's, is that linear?
H is a free form. Well, sorry, H is a free form, and beta is something that looks like this, right? And then you have H, K, L, M. So you just use beta three times to invert this. So something that has upper instance. That's what it means. So it'll look like A, B, C, beta, 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 A, B, C, 1, 2, 3, whatever, I, J, K. So this was the shocking thing for Courant and Weinstein, was that this idea of a Dirac structure incorporates two seemingly very different things: the geometry of a Poisson structure, and then on the other hand, the geometry of a closed tuple. So it unifies this is sometimes called presymplectic geometry, and that would be Poisson geometry. Okay, so those are just some examples of Dirac structures, and there are many other Dirac structures which are in between here, which are neither T or T star or their deformations. They're truly different, but I won't go into those right now. Okay, so is there any question about what a Dirac structure is? Okay.
The whole set of Dirac structures, no?
Well, what do you mean by that? I guess a lot is known about them, but you might ask the same thing about a Poisson structure. Are Poisson structures classified? I'm not sure what answer that would have, because they have no local standard form of what was. They don't have Darboux coordinates, so I don't know what that would mean. But algebraically, I mean, they're all there. Okay, so I just want to mention some important kind of general properties of these Dirac structures. So we saw that L, so the sections of L form Lie algebra under the Courant bracket, right? So we checked that it was actually a Lie algebra. So actually what this is called is a Lie algebroid. The reason it's called the algebraoid is because there's a natural map, there's a projection map from L to the tangent bundle. Remember that L is sitting inside T plus T star, so we can always project it down to T. And this projection is a Lie algebra homomorphism. So if you take a section of L, then when you map it to T, there's a Lie bracket here, there's a Lie bracket there, and this is a Lie algebra homomorphism. So they call this a Lie algebraoid, and a kind of fruitful way of thinking about this is that L is kind of like a replacement for the tangent bundle itself. It's some kind of bundle on the manifold which maps to the tangent bundle, and it has a Lie bracket on it. So it's very similar to the tangent bundle itself, but it's like a fake tangent bundle. Okay. So whenever you have something like this, what you can do is take the exterior algebra on L star, and then let's say the kth exterior power. And then you can define an operator DL going to the K plus 1 L star. This is the usual procedure that we do with differential forms. If this was the tangent bundle, you would just take the round differential here, right? But you can just use the same formula, because this is a fake tangent bundle. This will work, because this is a Lie algebra. So here, what you get is a complex. So it's a differential complex, okay. And then what you can do is you can obviously take cohomology. So this is called Lie algebraoid cohomology. Okay, so it's like the Durand cohomology, but it contains somehow invariants of the Dirac structure itself. Okay. Now, I just want to mention one important structural property here, because this is a differential complex, which is a bit different from the ones we're used to. So remember that if we have this differential complex, the one that we're used to, okay, I'll just do it this way. And then there's another one we're very used to, which is the zero p points on a complex manifold with the Del Mar operator. Okay. Then there's two important theorems that we have for these complexes, which is that there's a Poincaré number, or a Dalbeau number, which is just the statement that these are exact as complexes of sheaves. So instead of thinking of this as just a complex of vector spaces with this map, think of this as a sheaf, right? So you can have forms on little open sets. What this is saying is that if you have something which is closed on a little open set, then it's also exact. So that's what it means for it to be exact as a complex of sheaves. But the important thing to always remember is that when you take the algebraic complex, this is not necessarily exact as a complex of sheaves. It's just a complex of sheaves, d squared equals zero, but there could be cohomologies, right? So with the cohomology is a sheaf as well. So H upper L is the cohomology sheaves of this complex. So this is just saying that, you know, on a little open set, what's a section of this sheaf? It's all the things which are closed, modulo all the things which are exact, and that might be non-zero. I mean, there might be something in that sheaf. Okay, so this is cohomology of sheaves. Okay. So it's a sheaf itself. It's not a vector. It's not a. You know, there's no reason to believe it's a finite dimensional vector space or anything like that. It's just some sheaf, which measures the failure for it to be exact. And then there's a very standard result that there's a spectral sequence, the second term of which is H, the sheaf cohomology of the manifold with coefficients in these sheaves, L. Okay, and this converges to the Lie algebraic cohomology. So somehow these sheaves somehow measure this discrepancy, but they can also be used to calculate this Lie algebraic cohomology of Vn. This is the, if you want, this is the hypercohomology spectral sequence.
Are there nice conditions under which this quantitative thing is satisfied for the Lie algebraic?
This is too general a context to give any theorem like that.
Okay.
But in the special case of generalized complex structures, then I can say something about that, which is coming up next. Okay. All right. So I mean, again, one way of saying it is that, you know, if we have a complex manifold, and we consider this complex of sheaves, it's actually exact. So it doesn't give you any interesting sheaf. The cohomology of this complex doesn't give you any interesting sheaves in the complex manifold. Okay. Whereas if you have a Dirac structure, the cohomology sheaves of this thing might give you some interesting natural sheaves which exist on this manifold, which tell you something about the structure. Okay, so, but now let's move from Dirac to generalized complex. So what's the difference between these two things? Well, at first sight, the difference is very little, which is that, a generalized complex structure, what is it? Well, we told you about it yesterday. It's a complex structure on T plus T star. So it's a complex structure on that level. Okay. And it has to be orthogonal in the natural metric. So this means that the tangent bundle T plus T star has a natural structure group O, let's say M. Okay. And then the fact that we're taking a complex structure orthogonally in this metric, excuse me, means that this is a reduction to U N N. And actually, this then implies that M has to be 2N. So this is only possible, so the manifold has to be even. So first of all, you have a complex structure on T plus T star. It has to be orthogonal with the natural metric that's on it. Okay. And the third condition is that it has to be integrable. Okay. And what does that mean? Well, here's the key point, which is look at the plus I, so let L be the plus I eigenbundle. Okay. Then, so this is a complex structure, so L does not lie in T plus T star, but in the complexification. So we take the complexification here, and then here we have L sitting in there. So L is sitting in the complexification. And not only that, but the minus I eigenbundle is sitting there too, like that. Okay. And just notice that because J is orthogonal, take two sections, L1 and L2, inside L. Then what's their inner product? Well, these are in L, so it's the plus I eigenbundle. So first of all, it's equal to minus I L1 I L2. That's just because I squared is minus 1. But it's also equal to J L1 J L2, because L1 and L2 are in the plus I eigenspace. But this, well, J is orthogonal, so this means it's equal to minus L1 L2. So that means it has to be equal to 0. So this just shows that this L is actually maximal isotropic. And then the condition here, what I'm trying to say, is that this plus I eigenbundle has to be closed under Courant. So this is almost exactly the same as it's very similar to a condition on a complex structure, right? A complex structure is a complex structure on T, which is integrable with respect to the Libra. The additional thing here is that this bundle has a natural metric structure and we want compatibility. So in particular, this is the same as if you want a complex Dirac structure. Which is L. L is a maximal isotropic inside here. Okay? But I say that it's complex because it's in the complexification of T plus T star, with a special condition such that L intersect its conjugate is equal to 0. Okay, so a generalized complex structure is, first of all, you have to work in the complexification, and second of all, you need this Dirac structure to intersect trivially with its conjugate. And then you have an equivalence here between Dirac structures and generalized complex structures. Okay, now let me just quickly say that. Here, let's say. Okay, so the examples, as the kind of primordial examples, as you explained yesterday, are a complex structure. Okay, let me put the minus here. And J, a symplectic structure. So here we obviously see that this squares to minus 1. And because I put this minus, this becomes orthogonal in the natural metric. And then here, because I put this minus sign, this squares to minus 1. And because omega is skew, this becomes orthogonal in this thing. And just in the same way that it was amazing that Dirac structures told you that Poisson structures have to be, you know, well, that bivectors have to be Poisson, and then two points have to be closed. This tells you, so integrability implies that, first of all, this has to be an integrable complex structure, and this has to be d omega equals zero. So the Courant integrability condition interpolates between this complex condition and the symplectic condition. Okay. So right away, we see that, remember that this bundle is an elliptic is a complex of sheaves. Okay. Just as before, for the Dirac structure. But the important thing is that because of this condition, because this intersects trivially with its conjugate, this is actually an elliptic complex. This is an important fact. And this is this elliptic complex governs the deformation theory. And you can look at my thesis for theorems about this deformation theory, but I'm not going to talk about it too much here. Just to mention that elliptic complex is what's controlling the deformation theory. Okay, so I just want to look at that complex in these two special cases because it's important to see what they do. So we have this natural complex. So for a complex manifold, then what does this complex look like? Well, we want to know what is the plus I, so what is L? L is the plus I eigenspace of this. So the plus I eigenspace is going to be T 0, 1 for the tangent bundle and T star 1, 0 for this. That's the plus I eigenspace for this map. So L is equal to T 0, 1 plus T star 1, 0. Okay. And then let's see. So what's this complex look like? Well, first we have just complex functions on the manifold, which is just this is just wedge zero of L star. But then we have L star itself, which is C infinity T star 0, 1. Plus C infinity T 1 0. This is, I'll write them beneath. This is wedge 0 L star. This is wedge 1 L star. Okay. And then here we have, I'll just write at the end of the next one, wedge 2 T star 0 1 plus T 1 0 tensor T star 0 1 plus C infinity wedge 2 T 1 0. And it goes on like this. So we know that this has a natural differential operator mapping here to here to here. Okay. And what is that operator? It's just the d bar operator. So the del bar operator acts like this. Okay. But the d bar operator doesn't go into holomorphic tangent bundle, but it goes from here to here, and goes from here to here. And similarly, it'll go like that. Okay. So right away, so we see that somehow this complex is a little bit more than what we're used to. What we're used to is just the top row here, the Dalbeau complex. But here we're putting in the tangent bundle, and then the second exterior power of the tangent bundle, etc. So what are the cohomology sheaves of this complex? Well, if let's say we're here, right, then we say look at anything closed in a small open set, modulo anything exact. Well, anything closed here is going to be exact here because this is the Poincaré lemma, okay, for the Dalbeau complex. But anything closed here certainly is not coming from here, and anything closed here is a holomorphic tangent vector. So this sheaf is actually the sheaf wedge powers of the holomorphic tangent sheaf. So what this means right away is that if you view a complex manifold as a complex Dirac structure, then the natural elliptic complex that you get has cohomology. It's not an elliptic, it's not an exact complex, it has cohomology, and the cohomology sheaves are exactly these natural sheaves, the holomorphic powers of the holomorphic tangent sheaf. Okay. And then in the symplectic case, it's slightly less interesting, but unsurprising. So the plus I eigenspace here is just a graph, the plus I is just a graph of I omega. So it's inside T plus T star. It's sitting in here as a graph. And so then we have this complex called star. But there's a map. There's a natural projection map onto the tangent bundle, right? So this complex is actually isomorphic to the round complex. But it's the complexifying round complex, because this map is mapping to the complex tangent bundle. So that means that the holomorph, what are the sheaves of this complex? So this is just a complex, the round complex. Well, they're, first of all, they're zero for all k greater than zero, and it's C for k equal to zero. So the only sheaf that you get, the only natural sheaf that you get coming out of this symplectic structure is the constant sheaf for the complex numbers. And we already know, for example, that the sheaf cohomology, there's a special sequence going from this sheaf cohomology to the Dirac cohomology. And this is just the Dirac theorem. So this is just what I said before about Dirac structures, but in this case. Okay. All right, so this is kind of how a generalized complex structure would look like, except that there would be no natural splitting in this way. Like, just having an L doesn't mean you'll be able to split it. So this will just be some complex with some cohomology. Okay, so far, everything that I've said is, what happens if you have a generalized complex structure on T plus T star, and I've described the implications for the geometry of T plus T star, okay? But whenever you have a generalized complex structure, okay, then, so this generalized complex structure gives you this L, which is a Dirac structure, or another way of saying it is it's a Lagrangian subbundle. Inside what? Inside T plus T star, complexified. But if you remember from yesterday, there's a natural correspondence between what? Between Lagrangian subbundles and what other objects? What objects can we use to parameterize Lagrangian subbundles?
Pure
spinners. Okay. So there's a correspondence between this and lines, pure spinner lines. So that means that this L gives us a pure spinner line U, where, sitting inside the spinners, which are just the differential forms, but now it's going to be the complex differential forms, because we're in a complex situation. And remember that the way that it works is that L is equal to the annihilator, the Clifford annihilator. If you look at all the elements in T plus T star which kill you by a Clifford multiplication, this produces a Lagrangian subbundle, and that Lagrangian subbundle is L. This is how I've chosen U. Okay. So that means that a generalized complex structure has a natural pure spinner line in the differential forms, and this is called the canonical line bundle. Of J.
It looks like this could go for any Dirac structure.
This is true for any Dirac structure, yeah. Any Dirac structure is a Lagrangian subbundle, and so it becomes a pure spinner line. Okay, so in particular, if you remember, I explained what any pure spinner looks like. So any pure spinner looks like some constant, some non-zero constant, or perhaps zero, times e to the a two form, and this two form in our case is going to be complex, so it's going to have real and imaginary parts, and then it's going to be multiplied by a decomposable form, so theta 1 which theta k. So that means that at every point of the manifold, you get a pure spinner which looks like this. And this k is some kind of invariant, a pointwise invariant. So k is called the type of j at some point x. Okay, so at every point, this subbundle determines a line which looks like this, generated by this, and that has a numerical invariant k. That k is the type. And k can range from 0 all the way up to half the dimension of the manifold, so let's say up to n. Okay. And we can already see, so in the case of a complex manifold, then what happens is this part is gone, and we just have a decomposable n form, which is the top exterior power of the cotangent number. And then in the symplectic case, this k is zero, so we get just e to the I omega, which is going to be a symplectic form. I guess what I should have said here is that so remember that, as you said, any Dirac structure would give us a line, but these Dirac structures are such that L intersect L conjugate equals zero. So this holds if and only if omega to the 2 to the n minus k wedge, let's call this part of it here, big omega. Okay, so this is going to be true if this is satisfied. So for a complex manifold, then this spinner line is just the determinant bundle of T star 0, 1. So if you imagine taking at some point, take a top volume form and 0 form, then it's certainly the case that this is non-zero. So this condition is satisfied. And for a symplectic manifold, then rho is equal to e to the I omega. And it's again omega to the n is non-zero. So that's satisfied in that case too. And here we can even see right away that whenever we have a line, we can act on it by a spin transformation, by a B-field transformation in particular, and this is how the B-field transformation affects the symplectic form. So this would go to, by a B-field transformation, this would go to e to the B cosine omega, and by a B-field transformation, this would go to e to the B. Okay, so far we've seen that if you have such a generalized complex structure, you have this form, this canonical line bundle, and it has a type at every point. And we're going to see later an example where the type can change depending on where you are in the manifold. It can switch and it can be modified from point to point. Okay. But one thing that I want to mention is an important idea. So suppose we take this canonical bundle U. Then we know that what happens if we act on it by L? What happens if we do a Clifford action? L is sitting inside T plus T squared. It's the I over, so this is zero. This kills everything in U, this line, okay? But if I take the complex conjugate of L, right, then this is definitely non-zero. Right? This is the opposite. Right? This is everything that is not to be annihilator acting on U. Right? So from U, I can produce L bar. Okay. Then let's do it again. Let's say I do L bar U. I do a Clifford multiplication. But remember that when you do Clifford multiplication, you can decompose that as something which is skew, and then a constant term. This constant term is already taken care of over here. So let's forget about the constant term and put instead wedge 2 of L bar U. So now this will be distinct from this and from this. So here we have a line. Here we have something which has dimension of L. Here we have something which has dimension of wedge 2 L bar. And we can continue this way until we produce the determinant of L bar acting on U. And this again is another line. So the dimensions go like 1, L, dimension of L, da da da, all the way to dimension of L, and then 1 again. So if you just add up all the dimensions, then what we get really is that all the differential forms, all the complex differential forms, can be written as L direct sum with L, sorry, U direct sum with L bar U direct sum with da da da, all the way up to. So this stuff is just wedge K L bar U, and then all the way up to determinant of L bar U. So this means that the differential forms are decomposing into a sum of bundles. And this is exactly what we saw before when I had the first row, the second row, the third row. The differential forms were breaking up this was the complex of the Lie algebra. But now what we're seeing is that the differential forms themselves are breaking up as well. And then you might ask, well, so far everything I've said is algebraic. So U is algebraic in return from L, right? But what about if L is integrable? What does that mean about U? So, I mean, I told you that we can represent this maximal isotropic either as something in P plus T star or as a pure spinner line. But now we want to know, what is the integrability condition on this pure spinner line? Well, the condition is that when we apply, the condition is integrable, if and only if D takes U into L bar U. So what this means is that D is going to be mapping from here to here. So it doesn't have any other components over there when you take differential of set P U. And in particular, if you follow that line of reasoning, actually what happens is that it determines maps like this. Okay. And then, if you just take complex conjugate, then it will determine maps like this. And we're going to call this map del bar and this map del. So that may seem a little bit confusing. But if you just think about the complex manifold case, then that may help. Because what's happening in the complex manifold case is that we have N0 forms, and then the next step, so when we apply L bar to these, we're going to get, first of all, we're going to get N0, N1 forms, but we're also going to get N minus 1, 1 forms. So when we apply del bar here, right, but we can also apply, when we apply del, we get here. And then, so this is U, and this is L bar and U. And then we can keep going in this way. So there's going to be, for any element, there's going to be del bar and then del kind of U. And because this splitting is only special in this complex manifold case, in the case of a generalized complex manifold, this is all just one space, L bar U. Okay? And so here we get the right directions of the maps. So this is just like taking the Hodge diamond and rotating it. Okay. So this is the integrability condition. Okay, so so let me just let me just mention two more things. I'll mention the Kolodny-Yau condition, And then I'll mention, I'll give you a bunch of examples of this kind of structure. So what is the Calabi-Yarkin condition? So we have this canonical bundle U. Canonical bundle. This determines the whole structure. Okay. Now suppose that C1 of U is equal to 0. Alright. So that just means that topologically this bundle is trivial. Okay. Now choose a non-zero, non-vanishing section. Phi of U. So this is some generator of U at every point. That's a smooth section of U. Okay. Now take D of U. D of phi. Take the exterior derivative. So because this is integrable, we know that D of phi is in L bar phi. So this is in L bar phi, L bar U. So that's so that means that it's equal to d phi is equal to, let's say, alpha applied to phi, where alpha is inside L bar. Okay. Now, remember that we have L and L bar sitting inside t plus t star. Okay. And remember that L is null, maximal isotropic, which means that if we use the metric on t plus t star, then it identifies this with the dual of L. Right? This is a polarization, so anything you have here, it's a dual of anything that's there. Okay? So this is actually equal to L dual in a canonical way. And then you can check that because alpha is like d of this phi, this also implies that dL of alpha is 0 in C infinity of wedge 2 L star. Okay, so it's pretty reasonable to imagine that since alpha is obtained by differentiating phi, just differentiate again, and here you're going to get 0, and here you're going to get dL of alpha. Now, because this is 0, that means that alpha determines a class in the Lie algebra called knowledge. So that means that since it's closed, that means that alpha determines a class inside the first Lie algebra cohomology of L. And this class vanishes if and only if there exists a section phi, let's say, tilde of U such that d phi tilde is equal to 0. And this is the Calabi-Yau condition. Okay. So let me just say what it is in the complex manifold case. And it's very easy. I mean, the canonical bundle of a complex manifold, right? If C1 of this is 0, then that means that this K has a class. I mean, it's a holomorphic line bundle. So it has a class of H1 M with coefficients in the structure sheaf. Okay. Because this maps, so how does this go? This maps into H1 of M with O star, and this maps into H2 with M with set coefficients, right? This is the first term class. So if you have a line bundle, holomorphic line bundle here, which maps to 0 by the first term class, then it has a class in here, right? But this is actually sitting inside the first Lie algebraic cohomology. So this is exactly the same as the holomorphic class of a holomorphic line bundle, which is topologically trivial. So that's kind of maybe the nicest way to see what the Calabi-Yau condition is in terms of the Dirac structure. All right, so that's about all the theory of generalized complex structures I wanted to explain. And the only thing I have left, so I'll just give you some examples just to give you maybe some idea of what these things can look like. Okay, so let me give you a kind of bizarre example. So consider C2 and consider the differential form given by Z1. So these coordinates here are Z1, Z2, and Z3. aspect to it. Okay, so consider the differential form z1 plus uz1 plus uz2. Very simple differential form. So what can we tell about this differential form? So first of all, is it pure at every point? Well, if z equals if z1 equals 0, then what does this differential form look like? It's just dz1 with dz2. Okay. And certainly this wedge with its conjugate, dz1 bar and dz2 bar, is non-zero. So that means that it's, I don't have it up there anymore, but this means that this is pure at on these points. So on these points, this differential form is definitely pure, because it's just a decomposable, which satisfies the non-degeneracy condition. But what about if z is not zero? Then what does this look like? Well, what we can do is take out a z1, and then it becomes 1 plus dz1 plus dz2 over z1, which is equal to z1 exponential of dz1 plus dz2 over z1. So it's a constant times an exponential of a 2 point times nothing else. Okay. So this is also pure. Okay. Also pure. So that means that at least algebraically, this differential form determines a Dirac structure inside people's T cell. It satisfies the right algebraic properties. And if you'll notice, the type here is 2 and the type here is 0, because there's no k's here, there's 2k's here. So along this locus, z1 equals 0, the type is 2, and around here, the type is 0. Okay. So we have jumping type. Type goes like this, and suddenly jumps along this axis. Okay. Okay, but again, you have to be careful. We didn't check whether it was integrable or not. Okay, so is this integrable? Well, what we need to do is take d of rho. Well, d of rho is just dz1. So then we have to say, well, is this equal to something applied to rho itself? If not, then the thing is not integrable. Well, if you notice, here we have a dz2. So if we want to get a dz1, then we just take a minus d by d z2. And this vector field, d by dz2, when you apply it to rho, it's just taking interior product. So it kicks out as dz1. So this is dz1. So that means that, yes, it is integrable. And then, not only that, but we can take this alpha, so minus, I'll just call it d2. It's easier. So minus d2 determines a class in the first Lie algebraic cohomology. And I'll leave it as an exercise to show that this is non-zero. So this is an example where the canonical bundle, so the canonical bundle is generated by this non-zero spin at every point. So that means that it's topologically trivial. Well, this is C2, so it has to be. Okay. But I'm just giving an example where holomorphically it's non-trivial. So there's no closed form. There's no collodial structure here. There's no generalized collodial structure here. And that example is one that you can, and I'll finish with this example. That example is one that you can put onto a compact manifold. How? Well, I'll briefly explain that. Okay, so consider CP2. It's pretty similar to C3, I guess. And consider the complex structure, standard complex structure. Then remember that the deformation theory is governed by the algebraic cohomology. And actually, the tangent space, the deformation space, is H2. DL is the tangent space to deformations. So what is this tangent space? Well, remember I wrote down the complex before, so it's using the D bar operator. This is a complex manifold, so it's just a D bar operator. So it's really holomorphic sections of the wedge 2T plus H1 of T plus H2 of the structure. Now, we're very familiar with H1 of T because this is usual deformations of the complex structure. So this is usual deformations of just a usual complex structure. These ones are B-field transformations, topologically non-trivial B-fields. And then these ones are some kind of holomorphic bivectors. And these are sometimes referred to as non-commutative deformations of this CP2. But this is saying that if you want to deform this not as a complex manifold, but as a generalized complex manifold, then this beta is somehow tangent to those deformations. But I mean, what we're interested in doing is creating new examples. So we want to know not only what's tangent, but what is a real, an actual deformation. So I'll show you what an actual deformation would be. In the case of CP2, it's very simple. Suppose we have beta, a section of H2T. Then this is an actual deformation, if and only if it satisfies the equation del del beta plus 1 half beta beta equals 0. So sorry, this is holomorphic, so this I'll write Q10. Now, here, since we're on CP2 and this is a 2-0 vector, this would be 3-0. So it vanishes, because there's no 3-0 on a two-dimensional complex manifold. So really, that means if and only if beta is holomorphic. So that means that if you give me a holomorphic bivector, in this very special case of CP2, it actually deforms, truly deforms the complex structure into something new. Now, what is the wedge 2 T10 on CP2? Is just the same as O3, it's a line bundle. And that means that a section vanishes on a qubit. So if you have CP2 here, then there's a qubit here, which is beta equals 0. And what we're doing is we're taking the usual complex structure, which is J and J, okay, the usual generalized complex structure given by the complex structure, and what we're going to do is conjugate by this beta, doing a beta transform, like that. And then this thing, what the behavior of this thing is that it has type 0 everywhere outside this qubit, and it has type 2 along this qubit. Because remember that it started off as being type 2, and here the deformation vanishes. So that means there's no deformation happening along this qubit. Okay. There's no deformation here, so it remains type 2. But everywhere else, if the same thing happens as in that other example, the type jumps down to 0. So this kind of configuration where what happens is here you have a complex structure along this curve, and then in this region you have a symplectic structure, which as you approach the curve, the symplectic structure goes to infinity. Because here, if you look, the symplectic structure here is dz1 wedge dz2 divided by z1. So as you approach z1 equals 0, this B field and the symplectic structure goes to infinity. Right, so this kind of example is one that is important to keep in mind. Type can change, and this very bizarre singular behavior where the B field is blowing up, it looks very singular here. But if you think about it in terms of the Dirac structure, all you have is this nice little bundle. And this bundle is sitting inside this larger space, T plus T star. The way that it projects down creates singularities when you project it down to T. But otherwise, it's a very smooth structure upstairs. OK, so I'll leave it at that for today. And tomorrow, I'll talk about generalized Taylor structures. Thanks very much.
We have time for a few questions.
So this deformation, empty tensional deformation of H2, how do you see it?
Well, the way you see it is just that if you have L and then L bar, which is the same as L star, then what does it mean to deform? You just want to move it a little bit. So you just want to move this a little bit here. So moving it means that you want to graph a map of L to from here to here. So this is the graph of epsilon, where epsilon is a map from L to L star. Okay. So that's a little deformation. And then, but so you can think of this epsilon as being inside L star tensor L star. Now, you need this graph to be isotropic. So that means that here, actually, you need epsilon to be in wedge 2. So that's the condition of being isotropic. And then what you do is you write down the condition that the Coulomb bracket, this graph is closed with the Coulomb bracket. So integrability implies that dl epsilon plus 1 half epsilon epsilon is equal to 0, where this is the algebra differential, and this is the bracket on that you get from sections of, like here there's a zero, the Coulomb bracket is fixed here as well, and gives you a graphic distribution here. So you just linearize this problem, and you just get this. So that's why it's sections of the second one, so it's an H2, it's complex.
Is there an easy way to see how the type you define in terms of the spinners corresponds to the other definition of type in terms of projecting L onto T and T in one dimension?
Right. It's quite easy to see. That's the way I define it in my thesis. I think you just do something like you project a complex tangent bundle L, then you get some bundle E, and if you take E intersect with its conjugate, then I think the codimension of this is the check. Yeah. I mean, it's a good exercise to realize that, I mean, if you try everything that you can do in terms of spinners, you can do it in terms of maximal isotropics. And in Schiavelli's book, there's a very well-developed theory of, you know, if you have two maximal isotropics, and they intersect. They can intersect in zero, they can intersect in some dimensional subspace, and all that data of how they intersect is all written in terms of spinners. It's possible to do that.
What does the canonical line bundle look like for a quantum structure?
Canonical line bundle for a Poisson structure. It's pretty simple. So beta, let's say pi is a Poisson structure. Okay? So how do you figure it out? So the Dirac structure determined by this, let's say the Dirac structure of pi, is just the space of xi plus pi xi pi inside pi plus t squared. Right? The problem is that, well, okay, so I'll say it this way. Everything that I did was using spinners to be wedge T stuff. But I could have chosen to express spinners in terms of the exterior algebra of T. And then the canonical line bundle would be E to the pi, sitting inside the exterior algebra of T. Now, you want to transform this into the different representation of the spinners into the T star. That's going to be a little bit difficult because the Poisson structure, depending on the rank of the Poisson tensor, you'll get a different type. So it'll be something which changes type depending on the locus of the Poisson structure. I can't write it down right away, but this is, if you want to work with spinners this way, then that's the line bundle.
Let's thank Marco again. And a reminder that we'll start again with Yi Li here in this room at 2 o'clock. I don't know. So we're just going to be we had put him at 3 o'clock.
Yeah.